From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. From Nixon to Reagan to Trump, the Republican Party has walked the road to the right over the past several decades. But America is changing, and if the party doesn't change with it, can it remain vital enough to win elections going forward? As author and professor Thomas Patterson puts it, Republicans have traded the party's future for yesterday's America. This hour on Point, can the Republican Party regain the vital center? Thomas Patterson is with us today from Boston to discuss that. He's a Bradley Professor of Government and the Press at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also author of a new book called Is the Republican Party Destroying Itself and Why It Needs to Reclaim Its Conservative Ideals, released earlier this year. And Thomas Patterson, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you. Thank you.
Oh, hi, Anthony.
Thank you for the book, and thank you for being here. So you talk about the Republican Party falling into five different deadly traps. You identify them as the ideological trap, the demographic trap, the media trap, and the moral trap. And I'd like to go through some of those with you. Let's start with the demographic trap. Explain how that, what that is and how it's imperiling the GOP.
Well, I think the Republican Party is sitting on a demographic time bomb. If you look at the presidential election since 2004, and it looks like 2020 will repeat the pattern. Young adults, those under 30, have voted Democratic by more than 3-2. Now, we've only seen that pattern one other time in the last century, and that was in the 1930s during the Great Depression. In 32, 36, and 40, young voters voted overwhelmingly for the Democratic Party, and they stayed loyal to that party. And those voters became the basis for the New Deal coalition and allowed the Democratic Party to dominate elections through the late 1960s. And we're seeing that same pattern again. And as they've aged, they've become even more loyal to the Democratic Party, and they've turned out at a higher rate. And that group now is everybody under 45. And the Republican voters are concentrated on the other end of the age scale. That's where most of their support resides. But the future, if you look at young people, belongs to the Democratic Party.
Now, after Republicans lost in 2012, and you talk about this in your book, the Republican National Committee did an autopsy and concluded that they've got to reach out not only to younger voters, but to minorities, to women. And they concluded in this autopsy that that's the future of America, and that needs to be the future of the party. What happened? What happened to that autopsy?
Well, I think the Republican establishment embraced the autopsy, but the more conservative members of the party didn't. And certainly right-wing talk radio rejected that particular autopsy and that particular direction for the party. One of the right-wing talk show hosts said that it would wreck America if the GOP followed that recommendation. But look, if you look again at the demographics, you know, the votes, the groups that are increasing in number are the minority groups. Asian Americans are the fastest growing group. Hispanic Americans are a larger group, also growing quickly. And then you look at their voting pattern. To me, the most interesting are Asian Americans. You know, if you look at their profile, they look like Republicans. They have the highest average family income in America. They're twice as likely as other Americans to start a small business. You know, that's classic Republican territory. And in the 1992 presidential election, this was the Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush election, they voted 2-1 Republican. But in 2016, they voted 2-1 Democratic. Now, how does a party lose a group that's growing that fast, that looks like it should be in that party by that amount? And a lot of that traces to the anti-immigrant rhetoric that's dominated so much of Republican discourse in the last couple of decades. And it's really hurting them with Hispanics and Asian Americans. And, you know, and again, these are growing groups, and white America is shrinking in size. So the Republican Party is just on the wrong side of the demographics.
Now, just to be clear, your critique and your concern about the Republican Party, this isn't just about the party of Donald Trump, right? These are issues that long predate the arrival of Donald Trump as president.
Yeah, they actually start, I think, with Richard Nixon. You know, when the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed, and you had the white backlash in the South. You know, Nixon saw an opportunity. The Republican Party had been losing to the Democrats, to the New Deal coalition. But if they could get the South to kind of switch over, move into the Republican column, they would be competitive in a way that they hadn't been. And that was the basis for the Southern strategy. And then in the 1970s, with the cultural change that was happening, cultural conservative views became part of the Republican platform, and it attracted into their ranks white evangelical Christians. Ronald Reagan comes along in the 1980s, and his small government argument. All of those are movements to the right. So that started the Republican Party on the right wing, rightward drift. Then Newt Gingrich comes along, and he starts to purge the party of its moderate leadership in Congress. And that happened again with the Tea Party. If you recall, the Tea Party activists mounted challenges to Republican moderates in the 2010 Republican primaries. And, you know, in some ways, the kind of the middle of the Republican Party, the Republican moderates have almost disappeared from view, both at the leadership level and in terms of the party base. And that's positioned the party pretty far to the right. And in a two-party system, you know, if you stay out there, whether it's on the left or on the right, eventually you're going to be in trouble. And one of the things I do show in the book is that when you look at where the average Republican is positioned across the range of issues, there's twice the distance from independents as are the Democrats. And that makes them hard. It makes it hard for them to pull independents who hold the balance of power in our elections into their column. And we saw that in the 2018 midterms. Independents in that election voted Democratic at the highest rate in 50 years. And I think it speaks to the Republicans' difficulty of attracting moderates.
Thomas Patterson, I want to just talk a little bit, just to sort of help listeners understand where you're coming from in this. You're not writing this as a Democratic partisan, and I just want to read two lines of how you describe yourself. You write, "I'm a conservative when it comes to safeguarding political norms and institutions, a progressive when it comes to the quest for a more inclusive and sharing society, a libertarian when it comes to respecting people's rights and private lives, and a populist when it comes to paying heed to the people. I am an optimist in my faith in democracy." So is it fair to say that you're not offering this critique as a partisan, but as someone who believes in the need for two robust parties? Why is that important in your view?
Well, I think the strength of our democracy very much depends on the health of its party system. And I think there are also problems within the Democratic Party. And I've started a book on kind of the pathologies within that party. But, you know, I do think we need a healthy two-party system. But we need parties that are responsible, that kind of live up to the creed. You know, I think there are some basic things that both parties need to do. And Lincoln, actually, who's one of the founders of the Republican Party, said it as well as anybody. He said, there are really three things that we need from our political parties. We need them to support free and fair elections. We need them to respect institutions, democratic norms. And we need them to be instruments of unity and not simply instruments of division. And I think when our parties begin to stray from those particular ideals, then we begin to have problems in terms of our ability to come together and to govern this nation.
I want to talk about another one of the traps that you talk about. You talk about the media trap, and there you're referring to the power and limitations of right-wing media. Can you walk us through a little bit of some of your concerns about that?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at right-wing media, you know, it's come a long way since the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine, which gave rise to right-wing talk radio. You know, this is a very powerful force in terms of the Republican Party. But what's interesting to me, it's a force within the party. You know, it's very good at turning out the base, activating the base, getting the base riled up. On the other hand, it makes it very difficult for the party to do some of the things that a party in a two-party system needs to do. One of the things that right-wing media have done is basically to silence Republican moderates or to marginalize them. You know, and a good example of that is Eric Cantor, who was next in line to become Speaker of the House of Representatives. And Cantor said, you know, we've got a problem with immigration. We really need to reform that system. Let's work with Democrats to come up with something where we can reform the immigration system. Well, to right-wing talk radio, you know, that was traitorous, and they went after him, and he lost his primary to a little-known Tea Party activist. Well, that sent a pretty strong signal to moderates in Congress. Don't cross right-wing media. And, you know, it happened to Jeb Bush in 2016. When he announced his candidacy, he was far and away the leader in terms of Republicans' choice for the party nominee. But to right-wing radio, Bush was might as well have been a Democrat, and they went after him, and they went after him full-throated. You know, and by the time we get to Iowa, he's the choice of about one out of 15 Republicans. So John McCain, too, is another example. You know, McCain was a conservative, but he understood the need for compromise and accommodation if we're going to get things done. And by the time that of his death, McCain was actually more popular among Democrats than Republicans. So
we've really seen the sort of moderate Republican voice being pushed out of vogue. Thomas Patterson, stand by. We have to take a break. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party with Thomas Patterson. His new book is called Is the Republican Party Destroying Itself? We're going to talk more about right-wing media after the break. We're also going to hear from someone who wants to reclaim the GOP from President Trump. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party with Harvard Kennedy School professor Thomas Patterson. His latest book is called Is the Republican Party Destroying Itself and Why It Needs to Reclaim Its Conservative Ideals? And Thomas, you were talking about conservative media. I just want to play a clip from Tucker Carlson's show on Tuesday on Fox News. He gave a 10-minute monologue about the Republican Party with a sharp critique of a particular Republican senator, Mike Braun, because Mike Braun had expressed support for Black Lives Matter. That set Tucker Carlson off. Here's a bit of what he said.
Republicans at all levels could lose this fall. If they do, there will be profound consequences for you. People who supported Donald Trump will be punished. There's absolutely no question about that. There's never been an American political party as radical and as angry as the Democrats are now. Imagine them with unlimited power, and that's what they plan to get. In their first year, Democrats will give voting rights to every illegal alien in this country and then encourage many others to join them from abroad. At a minimum, that means more than 20 million new Democratic voters overnight. No Republican will win nationally again. We will have one-party rule.
So there's Tucker Carlson. Thomas Patterson, an example, I think, of what you're talking about, the sort of strident voice coming from right-wing media. What does that do to the political debate, in your view?
Well, I think it does a couple of things. Let me speak first, I think, what it does to the party. So Donald Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric, Mexicans as criminals, as rapists and the like, you know, if you listen to right-wing talk radio, you know, that's an echo of much of what's being said. You know, to hear right-wing talk radio, you know, recent immigrants are not real Americans. And they're speaking about Hispanics and Asian Americans for the most part. You know, the fact is they are real Americans and they vote and they're growing in number. And, you know, I do think the Republican Party, if it keeps turning its back on minorities and often demonizing them, is just simply in trouble because in another 20 years or so, we're going to be a minority majority public. But then you think about the discourse, and I go back to again to Lincoln, that parties have a responsibility to be unifiers. Now, they do divide. I mean, there are differences between the parties, so that's important.
Thomas, I'm going to jump in because I want to bring in Matt Gorman. He has limited time with us, and I want to introduce him just for a few minutes. He's vice president at Targeted Victory, a Republican strategy firm. He's also the former communications director for the National Republican Congressional Committee, and he worked on both Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. And Matt Gorman, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've been listening to Thomas's critique, and I'd love to get your quick take on what you're hearing. I mean, in particular, the first couple of points he raised about this sort of demographic challenge that the Republican Party faces. Is it a fair critique in your view?
Well, I would say a couple things. I tend to keep these types of broad statements very much in circumspect because, look, I remember very vividly in November of 2004, there was a big exploding donkey in the face of Time magazine saying it's the end of the Democratic Party. We saw it then in 08 with the GOP. And now immediately after Trump's victory, it was, can, you know, Democrats win the, you know, Iron Range again or the Midwest? And look, here we are. Biden's up by 10 points in most every poll. I think we tend to extrapolate so much in the moment and what it means to going forward. I mean, Thomas talked about our problems going back to Nixon. I mean, since Nixon, we've had five Republican presidents, three Democrat. Now, I'm not saying that we have issues that we need to confront. Absolutely. Mm. You know, as you saw, I worked for Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney. You know, but also I think I would be very wary about making broad extrapolations that in the future, which we can't even make accurate predictions 4 years from now.
But Matt, let me just jump in there because I have talked to Republicans in Washington and, you know, really sort of loyal party members who do express a concern about changing demographics and a Republican need to do a better job at appealing to younger voters, a country that is becoming very quickly a majority minority. And as we talked about that 2012 autopsy post-election, a lot of Republicans acknowledge that. And it doesn't seem like that is necessarily being embraced by the Republican Party at the moment.
I think you're absolutely right. That autopsy, I think, was a really important step. It wasn't. I think in many respects, Jeb Bush's campaign, I mean, one of his chief advisors helped write that autopsy. So I think you saw what could be, you know, in terms of a campaign kind of run on that, you know, I believe a very strong message. But, you know, also I think too, though, I think what we didn't see, though, when we crafted that, was that the base was in a very different place. It's not talk radio. Talk radio is not, you know, mind-controlling folks here. And Eric Cantor has nothing to do with this. In fact, Eric Cantor was opposed to immigration reform. It was John Boehner was the one who wanted to make the immigration reform deal with the Democrats. He couldn't because Eric Cantor was right there ready to snatch his job if he did. Hmm. The whole point about Eric Cantor's race was not about immigration. It was about him not being back in the district enough, which is crazy because we're right near D.C. But regardless, I think, look, Republicans have already seen a fracturing in their party when it comes to the base. We've seen this in 2010 with, you know, the Tea Party. And, you know, in 2016, you saw Jeb Bush try and run an inclusive primary campaign. It didn't work very well, unfortunately. Trump was very much base first. I think you're seeing a splintering now among the Democrats. I think, you know, if Biden wins, you're going to see now in the House a somewhat of a Freedom Caucus type model that can stop or adjust legislation that you saw with the Republicans for most of the decade. Now, what does that mean? I think now broadly, both parties are going to be base first, and there will be a hollowing out of the center. And I think that is where, quite frankly, I would be concerned much more than demographics about ideology.
Interesting. Thomas Patterson, let me just come back to you on that point. This idea that both parties might essentially be victims by this idea of base first.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, that was a point I made earlier. You know, in a two-party system, if either party positions itself on the wing, and it doesn't matter whether it's to the left or the right, which party we're talking about, when you move yourself away from the center, you're in some ways conceding the center to the other party. I think that's you know, in the long term, that's a losing strategy for a party. And, you know, I'd like to pick up on one of Matt's points. You know, I'm really not talking in the book about 2020. I'm trying to look down the road and these long-term trends and patterns. And a good example, I think, of kind of the argument I'm making is, you know, Republican Party, you know, white evangelicals are very much at the core of that party. They account for about 40% of the Republican vote, but they're shrinking in size. And, you know, the image of the Republican Party as a white party, actually, if you take them out of the numbers, you know, white Americans otherwise voted slightly Democratic in 2016. I think if you look at the numbers, you look at a whole different range of things, not just a single piece, not just a single election. I think you're looking at a party that's moving toward a demographic cliff.
So, Matt Gorman, I know we've got to let you go. We promised to let you go at 28 past the hour. So I'm going to say thank you and goodbye. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. One quick point.
Yeah, go ahead. We'd love to keep you longer. I'm just trying to respect your time.
Hey, I appreciate it. Look, I take his point. I do. One thing I would even look before we look at demographics, I would look at geography, because I think in a lot of places, geography can speak to a little bit of demographics. As we saw in 2016 and 2018, I did a lot of house races, right? And we as a party got hollowed out in the suburbs. You want to talk, I think he made a great point about Asian Americans really being a core demographic or should be for the Republican Party. I think you're right. We lost in areas in Orange County, heavily Asian American. You know, you look at suburban Virginia, not even just Barbara Comstock's district in Northern Virginia, which I think was in a trend blue anyway, but areas like Eric Cantor's old district in Henrico County. That is, if I am a Republican Party, and quite frankly, if Biden wins and in a second term, I think you could see a pendulum shift depending on what he does or doesn't do. That, I think, is really where this fight is going to be going forward. I think first thing the Republicans need to do, or any party, focus on the suburban voters. They're going to be the new swing voters.
All right, Matt Gorman, Vice President of Targeted Victory. That's a Republican strategy firm. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Sure. Thomas Patterson, I want to come back to something you wrote in the book, which really struck me. And again, if you'll permit me, I want to just read a tiny bit here. You write, the GOP would not have to abandon its issues in returning to its conservative roots. There's a thoughtful conservative argument about why countries need to control their borders, why they need to respect religious practices, why they need to protect the sanctity of the ballot, why they need to guard against overregulation. So what's happened to those thoughtful arguments for those sort of bedrock conservative ideals?
Well, I think they're still there in the party, at least among some in the party. I think strategically, they've been stripped out, that instead of making those thoughtful arguments about religion and immigration and the like, for the most part, the Republican Party has treated them as wedge issues. You know, and if you pursue the politics of division, you know, the way it works is you're going to make some people happy and you're going to make some people very unhappy. And to me, a really interesting example are Hispanic Americans. A quite recent poll asked them what they thought about the Republican Party, and 90% of them said it's either hostile to us or it doesn't care about us. And, you know, that's a product of the politics of division. And again, Hispanic Americans are kind of an interesting group in that they actually hold somewhat conservative opinions on some of the cultural issues around religion and the like, and on national security. There should be an opportunity there for the GOP, but you can't make headway with a group if you demonize that group. And that's the cost of the politics of division.
I've got an interesting comment from a listener on Facebook. Jeremy Fugarino writes, instead of looking at the party as a whole, maybe we should look at the election process, more specifically the primaries. With so few people that turn out to vote in the primaries, it seems only those along the fringes of either party tend to choose the candidates. As a result, we are having but a few determining the head of any given party and its direction. What do you think of that that critique, Thomas Patterson?
No, I think that's an important point. And, you know, primary elections really provide an opportunity for voters to have a say in their party nominees. But You know, when a party moves toward one of the wings, as the Republican Party has moved toward the right, you know, the voters who turn out in primaries are going to be those who hold the most intense views and are likely, therefore, to be the most kind of sympathetic with that particular viewpoint. And what we've seen increasingly in the Republican Party is very hard to be a moderate and win a primary. And well, it happened this week in Colorado, where an upstart, unknown right-wing challenger beat someone who was backed by the establishment, even had Donald Trump's endorsement. That's a reflection of the type of voters that show up in primary elections.
Let me introduce Tim Miller, another voice into this conversation. He's a contributor at the online news outlet, The Bulwark. He's also an advisor for Republican Voters Against Trump. He was previously communications director for Jeb Bush and spokesman for the Republican National Committee. Tim Miller, thanks for joining On Point. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Anthony. Good to be here.
I'd love to just ask you what you, you've been listening. I know. What do you think of Thomas Paterson's critique so far?
Yes, I think I'm more pessimistic on both counts than both Thomas and Matt. I'm more pessimistic about the electoral prospects of the future of the party and regaining the suburbs than Matt is. But I think that, you know, one thing that we missed, and I worked on this autopsy that you guys have been talking about as at the RNC at the time, and I think that we did chart a path that would have been more diverse, more welcoming, more inclusive, and a party that I would have been happier to be a part of. Donald Trump went the opposite road, threw that in the garbage, and I think instinctually there were some smart Republican strategists who had this idea, but Trump, I don't think, was strategizing. I think this was just his lizard instinct. Pivoted totally the other direction to appeal to these working class white voters. And so when I hear Thomas talk about the demographic issues, that may be true in the long term, but in the short term, non-college white men are a massive part of the electorate. And if non-college white men start voting more for Republicans, more along the lines of, say, black men vote for Democrats, the Republicans can continue to have a stranglehold on the Senate and the Electoral College.
Are there enough? I mean, are there really enough of them?
Yeah, there are way more non-college white men than any of these other demographics, at least right now in this country. A vast majority of the country, a significant majority of the country, is still non-college. Now, obviously, that is going to change over time, but over a long window. And then I think there are a lot of other factors that come into play. And so, you know, I think that was a strategic pivot for the party, one that I think was grossly misguided from a moral standpoint. I think the idea of having a party that really only appeals to people of one race is problematic on a number of levels, and you can see it in the policy outcomes that are coming from that. Just the heinous policy outcomes of this administration on immigration and refugees, and the way Trump has responded to these protests, Black Lives Matter protests. So there are plenty of moral issues and things to be concerned about the health of the future of a two-party system that's divided along racial lines, but just from a pure electoral standpoint, especially given the way the Senate map is, you know, there are a lot of states where non-college white voters are the dominant demo.
Thomas Paterson, what do you think?
No, I think Tim makes an important point. I'd say this about the white working class. You know, they haven't voted Democratic since 1964, since Lyndon Johnson got a majority of their vote. And Donald Trump did very well with the white working class. He won by about 2-1 with that particular group. But it is a shrinking group. It drops about 2 or 3 percentage points with each election. It once was well over 50% of the American population. It's now in the low 40s. I think there are some signs of cracking, not big, but on the margins. And we saw that in 2018. You know, one of the divisions within the Republican Party is over this question of taxes. And, you know, we had the Reagan tax cut, the George W. Bush tax cut, the Trump tax cut. All of them were aimed at, you know, people at the top of the income ladder. And that sat pretty well with establishment Republicans, marketplace Republicans. It didn't sit well with a lot of the working class Republicans. And there was erosion in that vote in 2018.
Thomas Patterson, Tim Miller, stand by. We're going to come back in a moment. We're discussing where the Republican Party goes from here, how the party has evolved under President Donald Trump and since before Donald Trump, the consequences for the party with young and minority voters and the right-wing media trap. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the state of and the future of the Republican Party with professor and author Thomas Patterson of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His new book is called Is the Republican Party Destroying Itself? Also with us is Tim Miller. He's a contributor at the online news outlet The Bulwark and an advisor for Republican voters against Trump. And Tim, I want to ask you about that. Republican voters against Trump. There's also the Lincoln Project out there, a group of Republicans who are determined to deny Donald Trump a second term. What's the end game of Republican voters against Trump? I mean, so presumably you don't want Trump reelected, so Joe Biden becomes president. But then what becomes of the Republican Party in your view?
Well, the end game is that Donald Trump is not the president, and I think that's a pretty important end game for Republican voters against Trump. And just for folks who aren't familiar, our group is elevating the voices of real Republicans all across the country, a completely wide-ranging set of Republicans explaining in their own words why they're going against Donald Trump. And then we're promoting those videos and putting those ads up in swing states. And it's a complementary effort to what the Lincoln Project is doing with a lot of their national messaging. I think that it's been wonderful for community building to hear these voices and for these people to hear each other. Because I think a lot of people who live in very red areas of the country and have very red friend and family groups have been kind of thinking these things in private. And it's been nice to build this community where they're hearing from other people who are unhappy with the way the party's going, but they may not identify as Democrats. Mm. As far as what happens after, I don't know the answer to that question. I think that for one thing, it's going to be very hard for me personally and a lot of people involved in this to trust the judgment and to support a candidate for office in the future if they were supporting this absolutely incompetent and despicable and depraved president for four more years in office. I just think it shows gross misjudgment. Mm. And so I think that will make reentry to the party hard. At the same time, I don't think that we're going to be welcomed with open arms in the Democratic Party, which, as Matt Gorman was saying, is moving to the left. And we're not doing this in order to get some sort of role or influence within the Democratic Party. We're doing this because we want to beat Donald Trump and because he's shaming our country. He's shaming our party. And we feel passionate about that. And then the chips will fall where they may.
So I got it. I want to ask Thomas Patterson what where he thinks this ends up. And by this, Thomas, I'm talking about the Lincoln Project, Republican voters against Trump. What does this do to the Republican Party overall? Is it a healthy thing in your view or problematic? What do you think?
Well, I think it's always healthy to have debates within the party. But I think to bring about change in any political party, if you look at history, they change when they have to change. When they start losing a series of elections, that's when they begin to get serious about reinventing themselves. And today's Republican Party is an example of that. When they went after the South, after losing for three decades to the New Deal coalition. And, if my projections are correct about what the demographics suggest, what the problems will be with the Republicans' positioning, it won't be all that long before they start, Democrats start looking at them in the rearview mirror. And that's the point, I think, at which the Republicans will kind of rethink what the party's all about. I would like to see them kind of recapture the high ground. It's easy to forget that the Republican Party at one time had the moral high ground. It was the party of racial equality. The Democrats were the Jim Crow party. And one of the things that's happened in the Republican Party is that they've begun to imitate even some of the tactics of the Jim Crow era with around voter suppression, various ways of keeping minorities away from the polls. To me, the best example is probably not in the South, but in North Dakota, where that Republican legislature in North Dakota passed a law that you had to have a name and numbered street address in order to register to vote. Well, who doesn't have a name and numbered street address? Well, the answer is Native Americans who live on tribal lands. They vote pretty heavily Democratic, and it was pretty clear that the goal of that was to suppress the vote of Native Americans. And we just see this across, one device after another. And, I think the moral high ground is where the Republican Party could begin to reconstitute itself.
Now, is that what you refer? Oh, go ahead, Tim. I hear you.
Yeah,
trying
I was
to get
just going to say briefly, I just think that that's unfortunately wishful thinking and a little bit of happy talk. The issue with the party right now is not the elites trying to decide, where to pivot strategically. As we've been talking about, we tried that with the autopsy. The issue is what the voters want. And the voters of this party, as Thomas mentioned earlier, I think he was right on this point, they want more and more radicalization. I'm from Colorado. This Colorado 3 district, where a conspiracy theorist beat a pretty solid conservative, is a really a good sign for where the party voters are. And I just think that even if Trump is defeated, the movement will be to appeal to a party that is now much more white working class, because a lot of the college-educated suburban voters had left. And what we'll have is party politicians that respond to that by having more of a nationalist populist message that it maybe does not include some of the additional personal character issues that Trump brings, a populism.
But Tim, I want to push back on that, because let me just ask you this. I mean, I get what you're saying. This is what sort of party voters want. This is what hardcore Republicans want. But Republicans can't win consistently or in the future without a lot of independents joining them. So isn't that a sort of call to Republicans to figure out a way to appeal to those more middle of the road independents who are unaligned essentially with either party?
Yeah.
There are a lot of them out there.
Sure. I want to say I hope so. If you go to our website, rvat.org, and hear from these Republicans who feel alienated, these are the voters you're talking about, the independents they need to win back. But just putting on my pundit hat, I just don't see it. I think that the independents that they're appealing to are a different kind of independent. It's a Ross Perot type independent. Mm-hmm. It's a non-college, populist independent type voter that they're drawing in right now, and that is where the animating elements of the party is right now. And there are plenty of states. Look, the Republicans control the Senate, control governorships, control state legislators right now. This is not a dying party. There are plenty of states where that appeals. Obviously, in the big metro areas, it's becoming a dying party, and that will have long, long-term problems. But in the short term, that's what I see happening.
Thomas Peterson, you and I are talking here in the state of Massachusetts, and I'd love to just ask you about, Tim Miller mentioned trying to reimagine real Republicans. And I wonder sort of what that means, or what the future Republican might look like. And I'm thinking of Governor Charlie Baker here in Massachusetts as an example of a particular kind of Republican, of which there don't seem to be a lot of. But for listeners who don't know who I'm talking about, he's a moderate. He's laissez-faire, even sort of liberal on social issues. He's conservative on fiscal issues, and he manages to get real, you know, to be elected in a very blue state. Are these the folks that represent the future of the Republican Party that you imagine and hope for?
Well, you know, Charlie Baker, at least according to some, is the most popular, according to the polls, the most popular governor in America. And he's a Republican in a Democratic state. Now, if Charlie Baker ran for the Republican presidential nomination for reasons that Tim just stated, he wouldn't stand a chance. The primary voters wouldn't have any interest in a Charlie Baker. So I'm in agreement with Tim on the point that in the short run, I think Republicans are going to double down on the right wing strategy. I'm talking about the longer run. What happens after all of these chickens come to roost and they begin to lose elections kind of regularly and handily? There's a point at which a political party under those conditions has to reinvent itself. And it may be three elections out. It may be five elections out. But I think that day is coming for the Republican Party. In the short term, I think it's going to continue on the path. And there I agree with Tim. It's going to continue on the path that it's on.
Tim Miller, before I let you go, one final word from you.
I guess my final word is I think that there can be a grand coalition of the center. I do disagree with what Matt Gorman said about that earlier. I think that a suburban women vote plus the Republican voters against Trump and Lincoln Project types did play a big role in getting Biden elected. And I think that for the short term right now, there is a grand center right, center left coalition that can work through the Democratic Party. And we'll see what the future holds.
All right. That's Tim Miller, contributor to The Bulwark. Tim, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
And Thomas Patterson, he's the Bradley Professor of Government and the Press at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's author of the new book, Is the Republican Party Destroying Itself? Thomas Patterson, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for this book. I look forward to talking to you again about your book on What Ails the Democratic Party, which I understand is sort of what's coming next.
Anthony, thank you so much.
It was a real pleasure having you. Let me turn to Kimberly Atkins. She's WBUR's Washington correspondent and a frequent guest on our show. And she's been listening in, and I'm eager to hear what she makes of it. Kimberly, good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
So you've been listening to Thomas Patterson's critique about what ails the Republican Party. And I'm particularly interested in what you made of his analysis of what he calls the demographic trap facing the party. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I think that is definitely true. I mean, for any party to move forward into the future, this applies to Democrats and Republicans, there has to be room for growth there. There certainly has to be room for growth after an election that you lose, but even just to maintain where you are. And you're seeing Republicans really face the ceiling there when it comes to that decision to move away from that autopsy you talked about that focused on expanding the party to really dig down to the party's base proved costly. And the Trumpification of the GOP has made that sort of expansion even more difficult, if not impossible right now.
So what do you hear? I mean, I know you're in touch with lots of political types there in Washington. What do you hear from Republicans who sort of look at the demographic reality and say, if we don't sort of figure out a way to broaden our appeal, we go extinct? Are people sort of talking that language in Washington? And if so, what are they saying?
Well, that was the standard line just a couple of years ago when you heard from Republicans. What has happened since? And that's what I mean by the Trumpification of the party. Yeah. By and large, over the last 3 years, Republicans have largely fallen in line behind the president, whether it's because they're afraid of his Twitter fury if they go against him, whether they believe that he won an election that he was expected to lose, so perhaps there's something to this. Whatever it is, they've fallen in this idea that you double down, triple down, quadruple down on your base, and you make sure that they are pleased and don't worry worry about expanding the party. In fact, if the base wants policies such as restricting immigration that further constricts the party, then that's okay as long as that lets you win that next election. That didn't work in 2018 with the congressional races in that midterm, but the president is still banking that it's going to work in 2020. So far, the polls are suggesting that he's wrong, but by and large, the Republicans are backing him up on that.
Yeah, and about that, I mean, with his polls cratering, or at least showing sort of dwindling, declining support, even in some key battleground states, are there signs of any cracks among Republicans in Washington? I'm not talking about the sort of usual folks who we've been hearing from time to time, but are there cracks elsewhere in his support among key Republicans in Washington or not?
There does not seem to be cracks in his support. There are signs of cracks in his messaging right now as he's facing these big issues, the coronavirus, the economy, and civil unrest and protest against racial inequality. For example, on the coronavirus, you see folks like Mitch McConnell and even his own vice president, Mike Pence, saying that masks should be worn at this point. Masks had become this political fight, and Donald Trump was on the side of not wearing one. You're seeing his own Republican leaders sort of signal to him that that is wrong, signal to him discomfort about the idea that perhaps the White House has not acted enough on reports that Russians tried to put bounties on the heads of American troops. You see some unease there as the election draws closer, but it is not resulting in some wide breakaway from the president's policy, no.
One more question, Kimberly, while I have you. There's news from the presidential campaign trail about money. Donald Trump raised a boatload of cash in June, but then we learned that Biden did even better. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the Biden campaign pulled in $141 million in June. That beat out Trump's campaign, which pulled in $131 million. Now, we had been hearing a lot of time about the fundraising, the fundraising boom that the Trump administration was having. It built sort of an apparatus similar to the Democrats' Act Blue site. And it was really going like gangbusters, and Biden came out ahead. It sort of that plus the polling that suggests that Joe Biden is surging right now is a lot of wind to the back of the former vice president at a time where the president is really struggling. It shows it's further evidence that the Trump campaign may be in some trouble.
All right. Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior Washington correspondent. She covers national politics from the nation's capital. Kimberly, great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Anthony.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. You can get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. This program is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amada, Brittany Knotts, Liam Knox, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Tim Skoe, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. Thanks for joining us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.